and welcome to Table Talk, the Spectator's food and drink podcast. I'm Olivia Potts.
And I'm Nora Prendergast.
And today we are delighted to be joined by Dan Keeling. Dan Keeling is an award-winning wine writer, magazine editor and restaurateur. He is the co-founder of Noble Rot, which began life as a cult food and wine magazine, but then expanded to a wine bar and restaurant. In the last week, a second Noble Rot restaurant has opened in Soho, and the Noble Rot book, Wine from Another Galaxy, will be published on the 29th of October. Dan, welcome to Table Talk.
Thanks for having me.
Dan, we'll start where we always start, which is at the beginning. Can you tell us what your earliest memories of food are?
I think my earliest food memory is probably sausages, and a particular sausage from a butcher's in Little Chalfont in Buckinghamshire, where I grew up until I was about 3 years old. And they were very peppery, and I remember being quite obsessed by them. Then we moved to North Bucks from there, and then I guess my next obsession would be cheese flan at school. Quite kind of British foods, and my mum worked, so there'd be a lot of kind of frozen foods as well when I came home from school and had to make it on my own, like lean cuisine and Finder's pancakes, all of that kind of stuff. And then my mum was a good cook, although I did make the mistake of giving her Delia Smith's book, How to Cook, when I was at college in a particularly stoned moment as a Christmas gift, and I don't think that went down very well. But she was a good cook, and it was lots of things like spaghetti bolognese and burgers. And then I guess another seminal moment would have been going to eat at an Indian restaurant in Bedford where I went to school. So, you know, the discovery of curry when you've been eating such plain English food for so long was like a real eye-opener. And then from there, going to college in Manchester, I went to Manchester Polytechnic, which became Manchester Metropolitan University. And when you get your bank card for the first time and you're in a bus on the way to the curry mart and you think, great, I can just spend it on whatever I want, then you just start eating Indian food every day. That's kind of another big memory of growing up with food. So yeah, between those two things.
And were you always quite open to new food experiences, or were you a fussy eater as a child?
No, I've never been a fussy eater. The only things I don't eat are baked beans and Andouillette sausage, although I didn't get offered Andouillette sausage when I was a kid. But baked beans I still can't eat. They're too sugary. I love every other kind of beans, but I was not a fussy eater at all, no.
You are the second podcast we've recorded today where someone said that one of the few things they won't eat is baked beans.
Yeah.
So you're not alone.
Quite surprising. I always thought baked beans were quite universally liked.
They're just filth.
And Dan, you mentioned the cheese flan earlier at school. I mean, did you like most school food, or was it just the cheese flan?
No, not the pilchards, but the cheese flan. And we kind of, years later, over the last couple of years, we kind of did an updated cheese flan, a Comté tart. So I still think that a Comté tart is, or a cheese flan, is one of the best foods you can eat. And it's very wine friendly as well. So, you know, not that I'd have known that at 4 years old at primary school, but, you know, future kind of thinking ahead, I guess.
And when you weren't eating on the curry mile at university,
yeah,
were you cooking for yourself or more sort of student surviving?
Student surviving, I mean, when you're in student accommodation or houses, as you know, the cookers aren't necessarily the best. They don't have much kind of power to them. So cooking anything was a bit of a struggle. So it was eating out all the time. And then moving to London, I started working record labels, and I had a wonderful thing called an expense account, which meant never eating in either. So for many years, I didn't really cook at all. And it was only till I got to about 30 that I actually had time to devote to working out, number one, how to cook, and a kitchen that you could actually cook in that actually had good enough equipment and a good enough cooker or whatever you need.
So tell us about those years in the music industry. What was food and drink like on an expense account at that time in London? I mean, I imagine it was quite the experience.
Yeah, it depends how much success you're having at any one time about how much you can spend on the kind of restaurants you could go to. But if you're having decent hits, you know, I think a lot of people would end up in places like Nobu was very fashionable at the time and actually was probably a lot better than it is now. You know, lots of places. I mean, all the record companies are in West London, so there's a lot of West London restaurants. But an expense account is a wonderful thing while you have it. You don't have it forever, and you've got to just take advantage of it while you can. So
who would you be taking out for lunch? Was it musicians?
Musicians, band managers, lawyers, girlfriends, anyone.
And how did you then make that? So you then moved into the wine industry. Tell us about how you made that move from the music industry to the wine industry.
So I was working at Island Records. I was managing director there from 2006 to 2009. And there was an amazing wine shop next door called Robeson. And I used to go in there and buy wines. And I met Mark Andrew, who's my business partner now. Mark was serving on the counter and he kind of worked his way up to become head buyer at Robeson. But we bonded, got on really well and started drinking together after work. And I think with wine, you really need somebody that you can explore it with, because not everyone is that interested in nerding out over Burgundy or whatever. So we got on very well. And he used to do tastings at the shop as well, where he would get 10 vintages of a certain wine and you'd sell tickets and there'd be about 30 people. And that was really, really interesting. And that was a real hook for me with wine, that you could see one wine made by the same person in the same vineyard every year. But because of the different weather conditions, one could be delicious, the next one not so much, and then the other one average. So that was a really big attraction with wine, I think.
And how did that lead into wine writing for you?
Well, before I got into music, I didn't know how to get a job as an A&R man, so I wrote off to all the record companies and got, you know, hardly any rejection letters at all, but didn't get hardly any response. So I was also writing about electronic music when I was at Manchester. So I'd write for Melody Maker, I'd write for Jockey Slut and ID magazines. It was always a way to meet people. There's an old John Hegarty kind of phrase that or motto where he says, do interesting things and interesting things will happen to you. And writing was a real part of that, that it opens doors, that you meet people that you wouldn't necessarily meet and things happen. So I kind of had to rethink what I was doing because I didn't want to work in mainstream music anymore. So I thought, do I want to be a chef? And I'm 45 now and I like home cooking, but I don't want to be a chef. You know, do I want to be a sommelier? No, I don't want to do that either. So I had to kind of think more creatively, and wine writing was something that initially was to do it because it was fun, but also to open doors and to see what would come of that. So we started the magazine in 2013.
And working at a magazine, it's obviously, I know that there's a lot of work that goes into putting together a magazine. I mean, how did you kind of juggle all of that, having a magazine and then going on to launch the restaurant? It sounds like an awful lot of work.
Yeah, I mean, with the magazine, we started before we knew what we were doing, you know. I had no idea how to put together a magazine. I kind of knew how to write an article from writing for Melody Maker, but that was a long time ago. So our first issue was very much like a pamphlet, and it was cobbling together copy from a few friends. And then, you know, how do you design it? I mean, we had no idea how to do that. So, you know, the first issue was almost going to go to the print without any kind of illustrations in it. And just at the last minute, we thought, what are we doing? We've got to make it look attractive, because, you know, there was lots of good independent magazines around at the time, like Fire and Knives, which is another food magazine, or there was The Ride, which is a cycling one, and they all had beautiful illustrations. So it was a lot of time, but it wasn't a lot of time, because we had all the time in the world. It's like someone doing their first album, you know, you've got all the time in the world to do that. It's only when you get into it and you have subscribers and readers that you then need to push yourself to do an issue regularly, as we do now. But it's developed a lot in the last 7 years, and it, you know, we've got much better writers, obviously, and that's part of the trick.
I was going to say, well, you've had amazing people writing for it. And what are you sort of most proud of running in Noble Rot?
Oh gosh, I mean, there's so many things now that I'm proud of. At the start, maybe not so much. I mean, there's certain issues that I wish didn't exist, but you kind of have to get through them to get the ones that you do think are really good. But, you know, Marina O'Loughlin and Simon Hopkinson and John Niven are three of our columnists, and each one of them, I think, is a brilliant and inspirational writer. So I'm very proud of those people being involved. You know, Brian Eno was an amazing interview that we did, and it was no surprise that Brian was as into his sense of smell as he was into the visual or the kind of audio side of what he was doing. So I think meeting him was kind of like meeting a hero. And I know people say don't meet your heroes, but everyone should meet Brian Eno. But we've had lots of people from food, like Nigella and Fergus Henderson, other people from music, Mark Ronson, and then, you know, people like Caitlin Moran, for example, who, again, is a really brilliant writer and someone really proud to have in the magazine.
When you started the magazine, were you deliberately trying to do something different to what existed within food media at that point?
Yeah, I think so. We wanted to balance it between wine and food, and that's still an important consideration for us. You know, fundamentally, I think we were thinking of it as a wine magazine, but if it's just a wine magazine, it can become quite dense and quite dry, ironically. So we didn't want to scare people off. So wine is always drunk alongside food. A lot of other wine magazines, although, you know, we had a lot of respect for them, they would talk about wine as if it existed in a bubble, and it would all be about points, and it would all be about price, and it wasn't so much about culture, and it wasn't so much about the enjoyment of it. And I think that's what we try and express in the magazine, is an enjoyment of food and wine and the culture and the people. And that's one of the things that a lot of the other wine mags weren't doing.
And how do you go from a magazine to a restaurant? Because that is quite a jump.
Yeah, I've got no idea how that happened, really.
What was the point when you said, we need to turn this into a restaurant?
We need to turn this into a living, and a living doesn't really come from a magazine unless you have advertisers and unless you scale it up and you do it weekly, which is not really what we're doing. So we did think about wine retail, but restaurants is something that obviously we love and have always loved. Mark, my business partner, he managed a pub called the William IV in Ladbroke Grove, Harrow Road, around there. So he had experience of front of house. And my wife's cousin is Stephen Harris, the chef owner at the Sportsman down in Seasalter. So when he said, you know, we said that we might be interested in doing a wine bar initially, he said, oh, well, let me know and I'll help you out with the food. And that was just an amazing thing to have.
This, you can't really say no to that, can you?
No, I mean, Stephen is a culinary genius. So to have him on board, it was like, well, okay, maybe we can do something. And then we started looking for properties and we got some investment and we found the place on Lamb's Conduit Street. And I guess it's just about not being scared to crack on and do something, because you can think of so many reasons why not to do it. Like, you know, there's so many reasons why not to do a restaurant. Like, I have no fucking idea how to do a restaurant at the beginning. But it's the same with a magazine, and sometimes you have to make that leap of faith. And if you know a subject because you've been to a lot of places and you've eaten widely, then that counts for something as well. And Mark had a background in wine buying from the shop as well. So, you know, and we both had lots of contacts with sellers where we would go and, you know, go the extra mile to find wines that you can't get anywhere else. And also it was about somewhere that we would like to go ourselves and that doesn't take the piss out of the customers with stupid margins on wine. And the further up the list you go at Noble Rot, the margin decreases. So, we want people to come in and drink interesting, rare wines and explore wine rather than just it sit there and it become a museum piece, which it does in so many restaurants.
I think, I mean, Noble Rot, if anyone who's been there will know that it sort of feels like an institution and on Lamb's Conduit Street already. I mean, what's the secret to that? Because, I mean, it hasn't really been there for very long, relatively, compared to some restaurants in London. What's the secret to making somewhere feel so kind of welcoming and lovely to go into?
Well, I mean, a lot of people have said over the last 5 years that it felt like we've been there forever. I mean, although we haven't been there forever, the place has been there, certainly since 1701, which is when it was built. It was turned into a wine bar in, I think, 1973. So the first thing is the building. The building seeps this kind of good living that's been in it for generations and for years. But the second thing is the people that are there, and that's the customers, obviously, but more than that, it's the staff. And it's about the staff really buying into the ethos of what we're trying to do and be excited to do something that is a bit different and to be excited to go to work and for it to be a bit of a place of learning for them as well. You know, they get to come in and taste all these fantastic wines, and we're all on a bit of a journey of exploration with wine. So I think it's that. And, you know, we spend a lot of time with training and, you know, everything, how staff speak to customers, how they make them feel. You know, you've got to treat your customers like they're special. It's a bubble where they can come in and forget about the world for a while. So it's people. And I think that's the one thing I've learned in both music and in restaurants, is it all comes down to people and teams of people. And that's what makes something feel like an institution or feel like a record label. Values, you know, that's the difference.
And you've just opened a second site on Greek Street in Soho. How has it been opening a restaurant in a pandemic?
I couldn't have hoped for a better time, really. Yeah, slightly surreal, but there's never a perfect time for anything, I believe. So, I mean, now is especially challenging, as we know, and it changes on a weekly or daily basis. It's been very well received. We've had a lot of people in, and we've got a new chef, Alex Jackson, who was at Sardine before, and he's really hit the ground running. Again, the Gay Hussar, the ex-Gay Hussar, where Noble Rot Soho is, good living just seeps from its walls. It's so full of history. You sit in the room, you feel like it's been there for hundreds of years. It feels like a bubble. It feels cozy. So there's so many things going for it, but we just don't know how things are going to pan out over the next few weeks and months. And then it's about, with any hospitality business or any kind of people facing business, it's just about staying in the game at the moment and getting through to the other side of whatever the other side looks like. You know, things will return to some sort of normality, but at the moment they're not.
And what about when you're at home, what do you like to cook for yourself?
So for me, the ultimate meal is still Sunday lunch. So every Sunday I'll sit down with the family and we'll have, you know, beef and Yorkshire puddings or chicken. I'm slightly obsessed with squid, so I cook squid all the time, I don't know if my wife likes it quite as much as me, but squid stew or char-grilled squid or squid risotto. I don't know why I like it so much. Paella, Lebanese food, a lot of Italian food. You know, after I left music, I did a course at Leafs, which really got me into cooking a bit more. So, you know, once you know how to chop an onion and what kind of temperature a pan should be on, you can, and you have the confidence, you can kind of cook anything you want. So I cook every day. Every day that I'm home, I cook.
And what is your go-to comfort food?
So it used to be curry, but now it's always Japanese. So I love Japanese, and a lot of the time it might not be in the most salubrious Japanese restaurants. It might be somewhere that's just close by to work, because, you know, you don't always have a lot of time. But I'd say that's my go-to. I mean, it's my go-to as well because I can't cook Japanese at home. It's very hard. I always get it slightly wrong. I can cook Italian at home quite well, but not Japanese. And the best Japanese I think I've been to is a place called Sushi Ginza, New York, which is on Fifth Avenue. And it's an omakase place, and that is just out of this world. So I think that would be my go-to.
And what about wine? We actually often don't ask people what their kind of go-to wine is. But if you, I mean, is there something that you sort of always go for if you see it on a restaurant menu?
Yeah, I mean, there is, because, you know, if I'm eating in another restaurant, price is obviously a consideration, and I don't really want to be spending £200 on a bottle of wine somewhere with bigger markups than we would do. So there's wines like Guffins, Hainan, Macons, with very good value white Burgundies. But I'd say my go-to wine would be white Burgundy generally, or maybe Growler's Champagne or red Burgundy. Those are the wines I drink the most. It's just about finding the sweet spot with certain producers who really overperform in slightly lesser appellations, but their wines can be just as delicious as somebody who's up the road in the most prestigious appellation and charging £300 a bottle. But I do think Growler's Champagne as well. You know, these champagnes are a lot more kind of, you know, ripe and wine-like than a lot of the Grand Marc champagnes like Moët, for example. So for years, I always thought of champagne as thin, acidic, you know, mouth-puckeringly dry wines that I didn't really like. But this whole other category of Growler's Champagnes, which I don't think I've ever had a glass of champagne and not felt good after it. So, you know, in 2020, it's probably not a very 2020 thing to promote, is it, champagne? But I think that people should have a couple of glasses when they can.
Well, that leads us beautifully into the Noble Rot book, because within that you're exploring wine from off the beaten track. Can you tell us a bit about what the book's like and where the idea for it came from?
Yeah, so there's two parts of the book, and the first part is about Noble Rot magazine, you know, how I met up with Mark, starting a magazine, how to start a magazine as well, like having no idea and trying to work that out. Then how we started the restaurant. Then Marina O'Loughlin, who's one of our investors and consultants, she has never been able to write about us for the Sunday Times. So there's a section done by her, which is kind of like her review of Noble Rot, I guess, which is a lovely thing to have. Then the first section continues on with themes like how to order wine, how to pair it with food, how to start your own collection, and how to talk about it without sounding like a complete bore. And then the second part is a road trip around Europe, and it's meeting all the best, or all of our favourite, rather, vignerons, starting off in France. So starting off in the Loire, going to Chablis, Champagne, Burgundy, you know, down into the south, into Italy, Spain. Spain's a very interesting country at the moment. Lots of really interesting new school producers. Greece, which is a real love of Marx as well. He's a master of wine. He did his dissertation on Assyrtiko in Santorini. So he's a real kind of Grecophile. And then back to English sparkling wine. So it's a tour. It's a bit of a how-to. And there's some slightly more irreverent, humorous stuff from the magazine in there as well.
Sounds great. Dan, we normally finish by asking people what their desert island meal would be. What would you go for?
A desert island meal? God, you've stumped me on that one. I don't know. Do you know, my desert island meal would be, it would have to be more about the setting and the wine than it would the food, I'm afraid. So it would be Tour d'Argent in Paris, overlooking the river. You know, their cellar is just the most magnificent collection of wine I've ever seen before in my life. It's, you know, quite good prices still. Fortunately, the food's not quite up to the same standard as the wine. But the thing is, when you go to Tour d'Argent and you order a bottle, you know that most of the time it has been in their cellar since release. So a bottle from 1978 might have been delivered there in 1980, and having a wine that's been stored in one place in ultimate kind of conditions gives you so much more chance of it just being that kind of amazing kind of cloud parting, angels appearing kind of moment. So I'm afraid I'd be there trying to drain the wine cellar.
Dan, thank you so much for joining us on Table Talk. It's been so interesting talking to you. And the Noble Rock book, Wine from Another Galaxy, will be published by Quadrille on the 29th of October. Thank you for joining us on The Spectator's Food and Drink podcast. For more recipes, food history, stories and drinks, you can head to The Spectator website. La pauvre fleur disait au papillon ciel.